the University of California Santa Cruz, we've had the last couple meetings, we've had here we can close those doors, please. We discussed some of the issues with some of the construction projects and some of the related settlement problems with UC Santa Cruz. And Kimberly Gonzalez has gone up there through the site and looked at some of those problems. And she's prepared the written status report for you today, 9-5. And she is available to answer questions. Also, we have a campus map. Is that the overhead, or is it we have electronic there? So if we need to look at some of the specific features that are being discussed here, we can. As far as just an update, in addition to the written materials, we sent two letters to UC Santa Cruz. One was a notice of violation for problems with the Manley Building Construction Project. And notifying them they have to enroll in the stormwater permit for construction of the physical science building. And we've also learned that as far as completed construction, that there are some issue about whether construction actually was completed on part of the construction projects, and we may need to do another inspection to determine if notice of termination is appropriate. Ms. Gonzalez also met with Dan Blunk, who's the environmental manager of the campus, in late March to discuss the draft stormwater management plan. And he's working on a revision, and we're working on comments. We've sent that out yet. And then there's a long-range development plan that is currently going through the CEPA process, and we expect that we'll receive a draft environmental impact report about that, and that we will be preparing comments on that CEPA document. And this campus map shows lists several of the features that are discussed in the status report for reference. And we did approve through the chair. I hope I got this right this time. We did approve through the chair 15 minutes for the University of California representative, 15 minutes for Mr. Donald Stevens on this site. I can go straight to that. Is there questions of our staff? So, we have cards for UC Santa Cruz folks. Okay.
Hi, Dan Blunt, Environmental Programs Manager at UCSC. We talked a little bit, I think, at the last meeting. We weren't sure how much detail you might or might not want as sort of background about the university. So we sent you what I think was quite a bit of detail in your agenda supplement. We're not going to put up any tables or data or anything like that. You've got that already. Just because we weren't sure what you might be interested in seeing, what we thought we'd do is just present some visuals that just kind of skims over the detailed information that we gave you. Can you try to go forward? So how do you go back to me? So with that, I'd like to bring up Dean Fish, senior planner for the university, that will talk just briefly about the history of the campus and the historic setting and what has happened to the land before we inherited it.
Thank you. I'm Dean Fitch. I'm a senior planner, and I'm actually doing a long-range development plan as well. So we do anticipate the draft coming out in September. So very quickly, I'm going to flash a few slides about the campus. We're going to talk a little bit about the setting. We do have a consultant here, a geologist, that will help talk a little bit about the technical aspect of the karst geology on the campus, which is unusual here in California. The campus is about 2,000 acres. It's on the kind of northern end of the city of Santa Cruz. A portion of it's in the city. A portion of it is in the county, right on the edge of the Monterey Bay. The campus was a part of the University of California process that looked at three campuses in the late 50s, and the Santa Cruz campus was selected in 1960 and essentially took over the Cal Ranch lands. We are surrounded by mostly open space, city parks, Henry Cal Redwood State Parks to the eastern side, and Wilder Ranch on the west. The campus is kind of broken up into four kind of zones, and Jeff will talk a little bit about the differences in terms of geology of the various four zones, and identified that in the handout package. We do have quite a bit of topography on the campus, about 900 feet elevation change from the base of the campus all the way to the north. We are situated on a series of marine terraces, and again, Jeff will address some of that. The campus does have a very long history. The lime industry was robust in the late 19th century, and in fact, logging took place. The entire campus was completely clear-cut and logged and mined from marble. They cooked it down to lime and used it for building materials, and primarily in California. But it significantly altered the campus land and essentially laid the groundwork for what this campus has essentially inherited. As I said, the campus was originally looked at in 1957, selected in 1961, and the first students essentially arrived in 1965, a relatively young campus, part of a 10-campus University of California system. Very briefly, Jeff will talk a little bit about the hydrology and geology of the campus.
I'm actually going to talk very briefly about the geology and also talk a little bit about what type of monitoring has been done for groundwater and surface water quality and quantity. And I'm also going to talk a little bit about compaction gravity, which is a process that goes along with a lot of building up there. There have been a couple of water quality issues raised with that. The image on the left is campus geologic map. There's basically four rock types up there. The bright pink is granite. The green on the northern side of the campus is schist. The tan shapes are sandstone. And the kind of light blue area in the middle in the southern part of campus, I hope you can see that, is marble. And the marble is mainly what I want to talk about. It's distinguished from the other rock types because it's soluble in water. That feature, in a granitic terrain or sandstone terrain, the rock is modified by surface erosion by streams. It creates an interconnected surface drainage system. Because the marble is soluble, water percolating into the ground dissolves the rock, and it creates a series of underground caverns, fissures. Those voids grow over time, they begin to interconnect, and they form what we call a karst groundwater system. So in the marble areas, rather than having water flow off a stream flow in an integrated surface runoff system, it tends to go into the ground and come out downstream somewhere in springs. On the campus, there's a lot of places where these caverns intersect the surface. Where they intersect the surface, they form what are called sinkholes. These are pits in the ground surface where the surficial soils have actually sunk down into the ground. There's a lot of little or medium-sized kind of red blobs on this map. Those are all the principal sinkholes on campus. These two diagrams, the one on the right shows kind of an idealized cross-section through a sinkhole. It shows how the superficial sediments will settle down into the voids created by solution and how the surface itself settles over that. The block diagram shows that a little bit in three dimensions. The photograph on the left is an active sinkhole up at the campus. The diagram behind it is kind of an idealized cross-section, what that sinkhole might look like in cross-section. The creation of this karst aquifer, the interconnected caverns and voids, have a great impact on hydrology. This image here is a watershed map. It shows the watersheds and sub-watersheds on campus. It looks like a patchwork quilt, and there's a reason for that. The upper diagram here shows what a normal dendritic drainage pattern would look like in a sandstone terrain or in a granitic terrain, where you have the small streams feeding into successively larger streams and all feeding a trunk stream that exits the drainage area. The lower diagram shows something that might be more typical of a karst system. You begin to develop surface drainages. There'll be a few interconnected drainages, but as soon as they hit a sinkhole, the water tends to disappear down the sinkhole, and that's the end of that drainage. So you end up with this kind of disorganized drainage scheme. This is the watershed map again. The colored circles show principal sinkholes on campus. When the sinkholes serve to swallow a stream, they're called swallow holes. So this type of karst system, this integrated surface and subsurface water, it has two potential impacts on water quality and water quantity. One is that because you have these subsurface streams, any kind of contaminants that are placed on the surface can rapidly enter the aquifer and flow through the aquifer very quickly. It allows the contaminants to penetrate quickly, but at the same time, it also allows them to flush out quickly. The other impact is that, distinct from, say, a sandstone or something like that, with flow rates that are measured in feet per day or feet per year, flow rates in these systems are comparable to surface streams. You can measure flow rates in feet per second. So the system responds very rapidly to any input. If you have a large storm, you'll see increases in spring output at the downstream end of the aquifer very rapidly, almost instantly, whereas in a sandstone aquifer, it can take weeks or months or years sometimes to see the result. So what is UCSC doing at this point to track water quality and water flow? The long-range development plan that was adopted by the university in the 1980s basically laid out a program for water quality monitoring and spring and stream flow monitoring. The water quality monitoring program monitors 9 points on or around campus. This includes streams, springs, runoff from parking lots, and groundwater monitoring wells. The quality monitoring began in 1989. The samples were done very frequently in the beginning of the program. Now they're done twice a year. One at the beginning of the rainy season, usually with the first significant storm, so they capture what's called the first flush, and then one at the low flow part of the year, usually in August or September. The results of the monitoring program, I'm not going to go into in any detail, but the LRDP has set up standards that targets to meet in terms of water quality. Those include the California Title 22 standards for drinking water, Regional Water Quality Control Board standards for industrial stormwater runoff with regard to parking lots, and the local surface water quality program for the San Lorenzo Valley watershed. So during the monitoring period since 1989, they have met those water quality goals consistently every year with very few exceptions. And as well, the data don't show any long-term diminution in water quality. It's been consistent through the monitoring period. The spring and stream flow monitoring program, they monitor, I think, 16 stream or spring locations. They collect flow data at least twice a year now and have data going back to 1984. Again, there's been no long-term trend change in the water flow during the monitoring period. Okay, one of the other things that they've done to keep track or help evaluate the groundwater situation up there is to conduct dye tracer studies. These are studies where an FDA-approved dye is injected into the aquifer at an entry point, usually a sinkhole, and then springs and streams around the downstream end of the aquifer are monitored, sampled frequently, and to see where that dye comes out and how quickly it comes out is a way of determining what the flow paths in the aquifer are and what connects to what, basically. This slide here shows the project location. This is the most recent dye tracing study. There have been five done since the early 1990s. The project location is the new engineering center. There were two injections done at that site. The orange rectangles show the monitoring points around campus where they collected water samples during the six-week monitoring period. There were two dyes injected. One was injected with water. It was flushed in with a large amount of water. The second sample was mixed with cement grout, which is used in some of the construction processes up there. And that was also injected in a sinkhole. None of the dye associated with the water or the grout was detected at any of the monitoring points. Basically was interpreted to mean that there was poor connection or no connection between the sinkhole where the engineering center was going to be built and any of these spring or stream sites. So it was felt that construction activities at the engineering center would have little or no impact on water quality at the springs. Something else that I wanted to talk about because it's been raised as a water quality issue is where new buildings are being built up on campus, the site selection includes identifying where these sinkholes occur. This is a map, a site selection map that was done for the engineering center. There were three sites considered. The red areas are the sinkholes that were identified as part of the initial drilling process. Once the site is selected, the engineers come in and do a very closely spaced drilling program to precisely delineate the sinkholes. And then a grouting program is proposed to densify the soils in the sinkholes so that the building foundation won't crack. One thing that I think needs to be made clear about the grouting program is the purpose of the grouting program is not to fill voids in the marble bedrock. The bedrock structure is capable of supporting a building with or without the voids in it. The purpose of the grouting program is to densify soft soils that occur in the throats of these sinkholes. This slide here shows the marble bedrock with a fracture or void system in it. Soft soil zone below a proposed building. Brick panes are taken not to pump grout into the voids for one reason, because the voids will accept as much grout as you can pump in them, and it's very expensive to pump grout into the ground. So you go to great lengths to avoid doing that. What's typically done is we drill a hole down to bedrock in the bottom of the sinkhole, insert the grout pipe that's used to inject the grout, start pumping. When you pump grout into a confined space, you'll gradually build up a back pressure at the pump because you force more and more grout into a limited space. If the grout is going down the void, you don't get any buildup of back pressure. It just continues to flow down the void. So once the pumping begins, they watch the back pressure. If it starts to build up, you've got a firm bottom and you can begin your grouting program. If the pressure doesn't build up, you know you're losing grout down the void, you stop pumping. You pull back, you pull the pipe up, and you let it sit for a day, you let the grout set up. And the idea is to let that grout is in the tops of the voids, and you let the grout set up and basically seal off the voids from further grouting. You send the pipe back down, start pumping again. You may go through that same iteration a couple of times, but in general, in those projects, you eventually create a floor in the sinkhole, and then you can begin your grouting program. The grouting from that point takes place up in the soft soil zone. You're injecting grout into the soft soil and densifying it.
Can you wrap it up?
Sure. One more thing. The grout, first, because it's not pumped into void. Second, the other point to make is that the groundwater table in the areas where the building is done is at about 150-foot depth. The grouting is done usually in a much shallower zone, and there's not much opportunity for the grout to get down into groundwater. The total amount of grout that's been pumped at UCSC for all building projects in the last 16 years is about 40 to 100 cubic yards.
So we gave you a chart out of this study that identified a bunch of erosion drainage projects that we wanted to pursue. Different, unfortunately, similar to a stormwater management plan sort of language, but it's not. It's a specific set of projects for drainages on campus that you will be involved with closely as we pursue. But we have funding for that. We're going to do that. So if there's questions on the material that you see in your supplemental packet or the information today, again, we weren't sure where to target how much information you wanted at this point in time.
Mr. Daniels?
I have two questions. One is from the EIR comment letter. I don't know if you've seen that. It got sent in by the regional board. And it talks about mitigation funding. I'll just read it to you real quick. And it says, the staff is concerned about university's history of failure to comply with mitigation funds due to, quote, lack of funding, unquote. Regional board staff doesn't want to see this problem repeated for the 205 LRDPs, prescribed mitigation. Please address that university. Ensure mitigation will be a priority. Of course, living near the university, I've seen that over and over again. There's lots of money for building things, and sometimes money for maintaining things can't be found. And so how are you going to address that so that you don't end up creating problems but not having money to fix the problems?
And I wish I could decide that, you know, that was going to happen. Dean, do you feel like you can speak to that?
Yeah. I mean, all I can say is that obviously we have a mitigation program. We've accomplished most of the mitigations in the past year. We are obviously going to satisfy all the CEQA requirements. We're currently analyzing the impacts, and we'll develop mitigations with that. And that's where we are right now. And hopefully in the next few months, we'll understand what those mitigations will be, and we'll put that out in September.
Okay. My second question is about the sort of policy that the university follows with respect to impervious surfaces, runoff, and sinkholes. And one policy could be, let's just pave everything and dump the water down the sinkhole, because if we get rid of it that way, we don't have to worry about it. Another policy is to try and be a little more lightweight in terms of building practices and maintain some of the impervious surfaces and recharge and not, you know, look upon sinkholes as a disposal mechanism. So which in that spectrum do you think the university is trying to follow?
Let me see if I can answer some of that, and Dean may better be able to answer other parts of it. It's my understanding that the soils all around the campus have been characterized pretty thoroughly. A number of them I've seen in EIRs is rated as erodible or highly erodible. Then we've got some significant grades to deal with on the campus. It's, you know, close to 1,000 feet elevation change from the bottom to the top. So those kind of create large challenges in being able to infiltrate water and put in pervious surfaces. We do as much as possible. We try to recharge groundwater. Stormwater coming off of buildings goes out to laterals with, you know, sort of a like a sprinkler system on them, as opposed to, you know, routing them directly to a drainage. We do as much as that as we can. I'm not sure in the analysis of the design for those stormwaters, you know, what kind of hydrologic calculations go into how much water can this area take versus, you know, we got to take it away from here. I know that the campus just generally does have challenges with that because of the type of soil that it has. When it comes to new development, specifically, we look at impervious surfaces that may have urban contaminants on them, like parking lots, loading docks. And as part of the design, there is a designed in water quality mitigation for those areas. Ian, would you like to add something?
Jumping up and down. Just a couple things. That since the last LRDP, the University of Regents have established a green building policy, and it does address stormwater runoff. And clearly, when I address the kind of four separate zones of the campus, the north campus, and we didn't talk much about that, is a sandstone and schist aquifer. It will accept kind of infiltration and percolation much better than the sinkholes. Clearly, the sinkholes are the method that we actually take our stormwater to. Will we continue to do that? I suspect we will. We always, when we do design buildings in terms of stormwater runoff, we look at what the peak flows will be. We design to a certain parameters. We meter the flows so that we mitigate for the flows coming down the various natural drainage channels, etc. So my guess is we're going to continue to look at that through this plan and into the future. So I think there's a number of things that we're taking in that respect.
Can I follow up, Dean?
Sure.
I think some of the subtext to the questions about the LRDP generally and construction more specifically on campus have to do with whether there is a sense that the campus will be in a way demonstrating a new, a next generation of stormwater pre-construction and post-construction stormwater management. So if you just take examples, for example, where I live in faculty housing, that has one kind of set of stormwater management. But if we were to look at Mansion Terrace, for example, there are all kinds of things that have, all kinds of practices that have developed in the 15 years almost since the latest faculty housing was built that could make a big difference. Pervious concrete, swales, catchment basins. There's all kinds of things that could be done. How would you characterize the differences between, say, Ranch View Terrace and Hager Meadows?
They're distinctly different. In the Ranch View Terrace project, which happens to have some very unusual conditions, some artesian conditions in some seep areas, clearly identified detention basins, exterior detention basins. We do have kind of bioswales, bioline swales for filtration issues. In Hager Meadows, it's a direct stormwater pipe system that runs into a filter that directly discharges off the campus land. So very, very different control mechanisms, very different design parameters. And clearly, I think the campus is moving forward toward this idea of thinking in a much more kind of sustainable way in terms of stormwater design.
If I could follow up with just a little bit of skepticism.
Sure.
And cynicism. Environmental studies faculty are routinely asked to sit on the design committees that design buildings on campus. College A, the Interdisciplinary Sciences Building. And a typical process is that all kinds of very good environmentally sound practices are enthusiastically embraced early on, and then when cost overruns start to come along, they get kind of drop. Now, I know that...
That's reality. Yeah. Especially about value engineering is a fact.
Yeah. It's heartening, and I know that I'm quite aware of the UC regions picking up elite standards. That's a very good thing. It helps hopefully strengthen the university's resolve. So I guess what I'm asking is, again, to take the example of Branch View Terrace versus the older faculty housing, what's your sense of how firm those designs that you mentioned?
Yeah, as I said, and I prefaced it the last time, Branch View Terrace is an unusual design project on the campus. It's actually a third-party developer. We have an awful lot of constraints on that. There were, as we had done the environmental review, we had identified a series of parameters and controls within that project. They will stay. They're part of the project. They are part of the approval process. Will everything stay? I can't guarantee that. Is the direction of the campus to look for solutions that have long-term sustainability, both in long-term maintenance as well as kind of an environmental way? There's no question we do. If we can get them to a point that becomes, economically feasible and viable, and we get qualified contractors that can do the work and that we can maintain, that's what we're doing. That's the direction we're headed. So, my sense is I think we're moving in that way in a positive forward step. But I can't see the future anymore that I can do from right here. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Young and board members, for this opportunity to speak to you. I'm actually not PowerPoint proficient. I have a few primitive transparencies I'd like to put up if anybody can assist me. Anyway, just as a general background to the relevance of what this agenda item and what's coming down and coming on is that they're basically planning to double the amount of campus buildings. So I think they're at right now about 4.8 million square feet, and their new growth plan calls for another 4.3 million square feet of buildings, as well as roads, parking lots. And I believe there's another 500,000 square feet of building, approximately, if you count Branch View Terrace, which is a proposed project, and the Arts Area Master Plan, which is another 250,000 square feet, which I found out about a couple of weeks ago, and it's under the auspices of the 1988 LRDP, although it's going through an EIR process right now. For the first building of that, which is close to 50,000 feet. Anyway, so I think we're talking about a lot of development up there. It's not very legible, is it? Maybe I'll just read that to you. You can skip the transparencies. But the Stormwater and Drainage Master Plan, which was issued in September of 2004. I'm very glad that the university commissioned this study. But from the executive summary, it said that the UCS campus is currently at a turning point. Accelerated drainage and erosion problems need to be addressed now to ensure continued protection of the campus's natural landscape, and the ecological integrity of campus watersheds will be irrevocably altered if such rates continue. So that's what they have now, and that does not take into consideration the planned doubling of development there. I had a chance to review the draft stormwater management plan, you call them swamps, right? And in my opinion, as well as I've consulted with the lawyers for Clean Water, and it's a overly general and thoroughly inadequate foundation for stormwater management on the University of California campus, even if it did not have well-documented drainage problems. Now, I understand that your board staff, including Gonzalez, has requested more specificity for that plan from UCSC, so it remains to be seen how much more detail will be coming. But anyway, when that these problems surely had been recognized at the time that the swamp was issued in April 2004 because they were thoroughly documented in the stormwater and drainage master plan completed by the university's consultants just 5 months later. The stormwater and drainage master plan also advanced recommendations for the mitigation of the identified problems. And with this background, the swamp represents a denial of and disconnection from reality, in my opinion. The swamp fails even to mention, let alone address, the serious problems pointed out in the stormwater and drainage master plan, which include, ongoing channel erosion so severe in many campus drainages that it is a significant constraint to the use of drainage channels for stormwater conveyance. Sedimentation of sinkholes, limiting their capacity to convey stormwater runoff through the underground parts drainage system. Existing detention systems and drainage and erosion control measures ineffective in preventing the preceding two problems. I'm just taking this from that report. Potential irrevocable alteration of campus watersheds with currently prevailing rates of channel erosion and sinkhole overflows resulting from sedimentation, which in turn increase stream discharges and erosion even further, causing destruction of their riparian environments. The swamp is oblivious to general and specific recommendations in the stormwater and drainage master plan tailored to reduce these problems, including either curtailing all new development in the East Fork Moore Creek subbasin. Mr. Briggs, if you had that map that you showed at the beginning, you can see where the Moore Creek basin is, sub-basin. Anyhow, they recommend either curtailing all new development or requiring all new development to produce no net surface runoff increase, which, from my understanding, is the very area proposed for an additional 250,000 square feet of buildings, as well as a six-story parking garage. And that particular project, which is under EIR right now, does not even mention the stormwater drainage findings from the stormwater drainage master plan. Maybe I could give this a new name. Instead of the swamp, maybe we could call it the swim dump, swim valley. this drainage master plan recommends making maintenance of the natural drainage system a priority, specific upstream and in-channel improvement projects, and I believe according to Dean Mr. Fitch, that the university is intending to implement some of the mitigations that recommended by the plan, which would be great. It also recommends caution in North Campus development because of this area's high susceptibility to erosion. Now, that's the area that Mr. Fish, or the, I didn't catch your last name, the geologist, said that is permeable, has permeable to accept water, but at the same time is subject to high erosion. Under the draft swamp submitted to the board, it says under the section on land use that, quote, campus resource land located primarily in the northern undeveloped campus is established as an area that may be developed in the future, but is to be maintained almost entirely in its natural state. However, under the 2005 LRTP, we learned that UC plans a new road through it with major new development projects. There's an obvious disconnect between the draft that's been submitted to you. The Water Board has observed and commented on some of these problems in its review of UCSC's long-range development plan, and The board has observed that runoff quantity and resulting erosion is already a problem and expressed concern about new development associated with the long-range plan. And this concern is extremely well-placed in the sense that we're now planning to double the amount of development up there. The only commentary on the drainage implications of this massive new development plan is exactly one exceedingly general paragraph on page 88 of the long-range plan. The paragraph improperly de-emphasizes the generalized drainage problems documented in the stormwater drainage master plan, characterizing them as localized. It likewise misrepresents the quality of detention facilities, saying that they meet overall capacity requirements, in direct contrast to the conclusions reached after the extensive analysis performed pursuant to the stormwater drainage master plan. The paragraph offers only the sketchiest ideas and no commitments for managing stormwater. This one paragraph is actually more than offered by the swamp, however, which ignores the doubling in size of the urban area it is supposed to be analyzing. In its review of the long-range plan, the board further observed that the demonstration that surface water quality will not be degraded is required if sinkholes are used as stormwater receptacles. The swamp discusses neither new development implications nor this anti-degradation requirement. And am I using up all my time yet?
You've got 5 minutes.
Okay. Are you all with me? I'm not used to this public speaking. Anyway, there's been specific problems identified by the staff report, board staff report, which I want to reiterate here. The swamp basically ignores all of these problems, which also must have existed for some time predating its writing. The swamp is so general and divorced from the unique circumstances of the UCSC campus that with local references modified, it could be applied to a campus or even another type of urban area anywhere in the nation, although probably offering just as little value there as in this case. Had a couple of more transparencies. I don't know if they show up there. One has to do with, I guess I'll just read it. And I've put this in a letter to the board before, and so maybe I should repeat it, but it has to do with karst regulations from Monroe County, Indiana, where they have very specific policies. For example, development in areas that encompass or affect sinkholes or other karst features, in other words, sinkhole areas, is prohibited unless expressly permitted by this chapter or until it is demonstrated that the development would have no significant detrimental impact on stormwater management or groundwater quality. Potential impacts on stormwater management and groundwater quality must be identified, assessed, and addressed through written studies at the earliest stages of the development approval process. The above notwithstanding, the filling or plugging of a sinkhole with any material, for example, earthen, man-made, animal, or vegetable, in a way that adversely affects stormwater management or groundwater quality, is prohibited. And the burden of proof for establishing that there will be no significant impacts shall rest with the petitioner. So I guess in summation here, hoping that as this process moves forward, the board will require the kinds of study from the university to demonstrate that they are not adversely impacting the aquifer. Since they are in a hill above the city of Santa Cruz, the recharge of the entire aquifer has definitely been altered by the amount of impervious surface up there. And I don't think the baseline data exists to really understand what's been going on. The university this afternoon or this evening has mentioned some diatracer studies, which I haven't seen yet, or I'm not an expert necessarily, but I just think it would be valuable for the board to make sure that enough study. I doubt that adequate studies have been done. So I hope that adequate studies will be required so that we really understand the hydrology of the karst system up there before the magnitude, the kind of development that is anticipated will take place there. One mention in regards to one other detail that came to mind on, for example, on Grand View Terrace and the Faculty Housing Project in College 8. When College 8 was constructed, I guess it was the late 80s, 88, 89, they constructed a detention pond which silted up shortly after construction and has never functioned as a detention pond. It became habitat for California red-legged frog, and so they have to get permits to even do anything. I guess they can't do anything to maintain it, or maybe they tried, or maybe they didn't try hard, I don't know. That is the very area where there's severe erosion going on in the west fork of Moore Creek, which Kimberly Gonzalez and her staff is took a few photos. So problems from 17 years ago have been continuing. And I realize that the university says they've been implementing a lot of mitigation measures, but from the 2004 mitigation monitoring report, which the board has a copy of, almost all of the erosion problems identified in 1988 were never funded, the mitigations. The Rancho Terrace project has three detention ponds designed, which, if they don't work, my understanding is the water would flow down into the historic Cal District buildings. I hope that they will work if they are constructed. Maybe they won't silt up, and maybe they will function right, but I think that's something the board hopefully could take a look at, because I know that some projects at the campus, from my understanding, just don't work very well, or there's a lack of maintenance, as is outlined in the Stormwater Drainage Master Plan. They will come up with some plans, but then they don't have the money for regular maintenance. And if, for example, three of the principal sinkholes on campus used for stormwater detention are, according to the Stormwater Drainage Master Plan, are at or exceeding capacity. That's just kind of my general comments. Thank you for your
time. So I have a quick question for you. Do you feel comfortable working with staff to have oversight, getting questions answered?
I do, and I would like to compliment Kimberly Gonzalez for being very attentive and taking time to explain things to me. And I think she's been a pleasure, you know, to work with and been good. So I do feel comfortable.
Any questions? Mr. Daniels.
What's the status of the EIR you mentioned?
Oh, for the new development plan, it's the long-range plan. The scoping session closed at the end of February, where the public has an opportunity for input and questions. And the current schedule is for it to be completed in September.
Draft EIR?
The draft EIR.
I'd like to. I know staff commented on the NRP for that EIR. I'd like to see staff take a look at the EIR when it's actually coming out. I think it's going to be such a big impact if it's done improperly.
I was planning to take a look at it.
Right. In particular, I think one of the things we need to do is comment and compare this to their drainage plan that they have and make sure this matches those kinds of things.
I guess my main concern is that the university, the regents will approve the project and the development without adequate stormwater management plan. And then when they get to it, then they've got the okay to develop. Isn't it usually the case that developers have to have adequate stormwater plan in place before they're allowed to do the development? That's where, because they're the regents and they have all these exemptions from local land use regulations, and they are their own lead agency. There's nobody really, watching it.